Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert from the biggest sporting names in the world to neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers, and even former Buddhist monks. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is described as a metaphor for life, and this podcast aims to prove that right. Hello, thank you for joining me. Okay, in this episode, I am joined by Helen Richardson-Walsh, who was part of the team that won a historic gold for Team GB at Rio 2016 in hockey. Now, last week, I spoke to the coach, Danny Carey, and previously I've chatted to its captain, Kate Richardson-Walsh, who's Helen's wife, and the team's top scorer, Alex Danson. Now, Helen scored one of the crucial penalty shootout goals in the Rio Olympic final, as Britain's women won gold for the first time in history. And the story of how the team climbed to the top of that mountain is a fascinating one. And really, it began back when London was awarded the Olympic Games in 2005, which secured funding for hockey because they were just staring into the abyss at that time after failing to qualify for Athens in 2004. In 2009, the team began conversations around values, behaviours and a vision, which really began the process of them actually winning medals, which included bronze in 2012. But there was a big dip in 2014. Helen was sidelined as she was recovering from back surgery. She had mental health difficulties at that time too. And the team was in free fall. They finished 11th at the World Cup. They were really divided, full of internal strife. But that low point proved to be something of a blessing. Danny Carey was brought back in as coach, and the team had a meeting where all the ill feeling was addressed and released. After that incredibly tough conversation, the side regrouped and together they set a new vision and drew up a new set of values. And 2 years later, it's no coincidence, the team won gold in Rio. So the theme of this episode really is around having a vision for what and who you want to be. We talk about vulnerability, particularly around Brené Brown's work on the subject, and being the best of yourself rather than trying to be someone else. We talk about values and goals, about ego, and being the difference you want to see in the world. And of course, the team's famous Thinking Thursday. Helen is now performance psychologist at Tottenham Hotspur Women. She's a deep thinker, she's a laugh, and it was a pleasure chatting to her. Any thoughts or questions about this or any other of my episodes, get in touch on social media, and please do check out my website, simonmundy.com. But first, here is Helen Richardson-Walsh. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Helen Richardson-Walsh, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm really excited to have you on because, well, there are a number of reasons. There's so much to talk about, but I think you're a don't tell me the score first, in that you've won an Olympic gold medal, scored a penalty in the crucial shootout, you've turned your hand to becoming an elite sports psychologist at Spurs, and you've got a bus and a beer named after you. Where do you ever say to yourself, where did it all go wrong?
That is brilliant. I think that's when my brothers finally thought I'd achieved something, was when I had a beer named after me, I have to say.
Is it good?
Yeah. It's called Golden Hells by the brewery Magpies up in Nottingham, which is where my hockey began. So
yeah,
very fitting. Yeah.
Is it a bitter or a lager or?
No, it's more of a lager, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. Do they send you free stashes?
Well, it was more of a guest beer, so it's had its day.
Oh, it's had its day.
It was more of a short run thing.
Okay, so it could be like collectibles, you know, like Star Wars figures from back in the day, worth an absolute bomb. But the bus is still there, right?
Yeah, the bus is still there. The bus is picking up my mum because it goes through West Bridgeford where I spent most of my childhood, and my mum still lives there. And yeah, the number 8
Amazing.
Bus.
That's fantastic, isn't it? So just imagine the pride she gets every time she gets, or either that, or she's so used to it, she doesn't even notice.
Well, it's actually quite nice because there's only one of them, and it obviously has to do the circuit. So she doesn't catch it very often. So when she does, it's like, oh, on Helen, and she just sends me a text message. Guess where I am?
Fantastic. Right. So here's the first question, and there's lots I want to get into, but I want to throw a bit of a tough one at you first, right? So Olympic gold medal winner, penalty shootout under pressure, interest in the mind and performance and everything like that. All these successes, right? What is the key thread linking all these things? If you don't know now, we can talk about it later. We can let it percolate if you want.
My goodness. I think we should let it percolate. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Let's let that percolate. We'll come back to that. All right.
Yeah.
How's Kate?
She's very well. Yeah. She's really good. Yeah.
Now, obviously, I assume you know she's been on Don't Tell Me the Score, one of my favorite episodes. She laughed, she cried, and she cried specifically when talking about you and your back surgeries. Which coincided with Great Britain's dip in team fortunes as well. So,
well, not going to say anything about that.
To me, there was no coincidence. Anyway, yeah, definitely one of my favourite episodes. So I'm fascinated to talk to you as well, because I've spoken to some of the other team from 2016. I had Danny on recently, Alex Dance and Kate. And I think it's been interesting doing this. So I've been doing this, for 2.5 years now, roughly, I'd say, a bit more maybe. And there's been a couple of like sports and events and teams that have really stood out. The hockey team that won gold in Rio 2016 is arguably top of the pile because of the collective story, and then within that, the individual stories within it and the values part, the big picture, all of this stuff. I think it's one of my favorite British sporting tales. So I really want to sort of dig into that and get your take on some of the other bits. But we've got to go back, haven't we? We've got to start back. Before you had a bus, before you had a beer, before you had a medal, all that stuff, right? But you did have 3 older brothers. And I want to know, what impact did they have on you from a sporting sense, but also from a sort of perhaps a personality sense or anything like that?
Yeah, I think they had a huge, significant impact on me, what I became particularly as a sports person in the early days. I think since then I've gone through quite a large transition to being who I am today, through lots of questions and curiosity over the last 5 or so years since Rio. But just being the youngest of 4 anyway, I think, but we all played sport. Sport was massive in our family. my dad used to play hockey and cricket as well. So they were probably the two main sports. We also played tennis. My mum was also into sport as well. So it was about sport and just that competitiveness. We used to play like 2-on-2 in the garden and in the park. It was constant, anything like roller hockey, football, you know, we played everything. And I think just that, I think having, you know, had the chance to kind of look back, I mean, no doubt it kind of shaped me, that want to be able to compete with them. And because I was the youngest, I was always having to strive. I was always having to, I probably always having to feel like I had to prove myself, particularly as I was the only girl as well. Mm. I was wanting to be there on merit rather than, oh yeah, let her play because she's a girl and, you know, that kind of thing. I wanted to be there because I was good enough. And so not only did that make me technically and probably tactically astute as a sports person, particularly within the team game, but it basically made me so determined. Yeah. It gave me that drive to kind of be as good as I can and that kind of thing, which I think probably has been one of my greatest strengths as a hockey player.
And I'm interested as well in terms of your personality. It's funny you say that, as so I've got an older sister, just the one, but she was hugely formative for me. And in terms of, she dressed me when I was sort of 12, 13, stuck me in DMs, gave me a sense of partying, which made me cool. Amazing. At the time. You know, she had a huge impact. But then as well, you said prove yourself. And I remember, if I look back at the family albums, when she was born, there was sort of 10, 12, 14 pages of her, you know, as a baby. And then I was born, I think it was probably a page. And then it's back to her, right? And I don't think it's a coincidence then that I've been a gobby so-and-so, a bit of an attention seeker, like, look at me, hello, I'm over here. So obviously you wanted to prove yourself. That manifested then for you in terms of proving yourself in sport. Did it in any other ways?
Not really, not that I can think of. Sport was like, was my thing in the end. It like, it became my safe space. I think because of, as I got a little bit older and I started to grapple with potentially, well, my sexuality for one thing, and also, you know, dealing with the fact that my parents got divorced and things like that, I think they were things in my life that were also within me, and sport became something that was, I didn't know it. A little bit. I didn't know it at the time. And it wasn't even just sport. It was actually on the field of play.
Yeah.
When I couldn't, no one could ask me questions. No one could talk to me. I didn't have to speak. I didn't have to do anything other than just be myself in that moment on that pitch.
Do you mind me asking, how old were you when your parents separated?
I was 5. So young enough for it to not really know what was going on, but old enough to, you know, for it to affect me.
Do you know how it affected you?
In the early years, actually, it affected me. Well, it was put down to that. My kind of my reading and my writing, my spelling kind of really fell back. How I developed within those types of areas educationally, I suffered, which was put down to that. I mean, that's what I've been told. So that's kind of what I believe. And then I think maybe I've started to think about it a bit more recently and how it affected me as a person. Obviously you don't know, because I don't know how I would have been.
Yeah, of course. But
you know, start to wonder whether I did start to maybe go into myself a little bit. I didn't, but that could have just been me. That could have just been who I was anyway. But yeah, certainly lots of, I mean, but that one thing that I have realized about myself is that I'm a real thinker, and that's led me to some dark places, but it's also allowed me to really, I actually enjoy it. I enjoy kind of being in this space of not knowing, and actually that's okay.
Yeah.
Like really, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we did within the team has allowed me to access this area of my kind of thought pathway, because at the start of our career, we didn't do a huge amount of this, but you know, at the end, we really got in touch with who we were as people, and worked with our psychologists and that kind of thing, which I'm sure we'll come on to. And I think there was a part of me that was wanting to find answers and that kind of stuff, but actually, just that knowing of that we all develop, we grow, we change, and actually that's okay, and that's and that's good, and being I'm just happy with being curious about stuff.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful and quite profound, because like you say, being comfortable not knowing, because the thing is, we don't know, do we? I mean, the world is always changing. Who know? I mean, we literally don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We kid ourselves that we do, but we don't. And it's like the temptation can be to try and control things in such a way, or get and become a bit controlling, if you like, to try and make ourselves feel better inside. But that's it's a fool's errand, really, isn't it? But like you say, it sounds more like you've gone into, okay, no, I'm okay with that, but it's more about just exploring. Like just letting go of any fixed ideas, if you like.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think obviously this last year has forced all of us to do that in some respects. And I think because I've had my hockey, that's ended now, unfortunately. Mm. It had to end.
Yeah.
And so I've had to be forced into another path, and I could, you know, be massively affected by a want to be perfect at something else, but I don't need that. I know that I'm starting a new journey, as whether it's a psychologist, a coach, you know, whatever it is. I feel like I want to help people. I feel like I want to help others get the best out of themselves. And I know what help I needed in order to do that, so I want to try and translate that into a new world. And I know that I'm not going to be, I know that I'm not going to be amazing at that straight away, but I also know that it's not about being amazing at it. I just want to learn and grow and get better at it. You know, I've really, really have a great admiration for Brené Brown.
I know you do. Yeah.
You and Kate, yeah. Yeah. And she was someone who I first listened to when I was in my deep, dark hole, who helped me get out of that. And what I've learned from listening to people like her and people like her, and is that it is about the person. And I first had to understand me, and then, you know, really, what do I value? What do I want to be about? These are all questions I wish kind of asked, been helped, encouraged to ask when I was a lot younger. Although I was saying this to one of the footballers I was talking to the other day at Spurs, I don't know if I would have been in a place to even make sense of that anyway when I was younger. So I don't know if there is a sense of time that you need. Do you need to be older? I don't know.
And also, I think a lot of teams, organisations, people don't go through that process in the way that you all did. And I like I said, in terms of the story of you guys and what you achieved, but the way you achieved it, and that values piece, and the behaviors, and the vision, and the wanting to inspire, and everything like that, I don't know of another example where it's been as powerful as it was with you all. And like you say, it's something I really want to get into, and that whole the Brené Brown stuff really feeds into that, and authenticity and all that kind of stuff. But you said something a minute ago about you've started this new thing, and you don't have to be brilliant now, right? But that's okay. And it's about learning and growing and getting better. And it made me think, because I often talk about, I did an episode with Goldie Sayers, who I'm sure you probably know.
Yeah.
And it was about the journey, right? So we always call it the journey. And it's like, but then it's like, okay, but what does that mean? And I think that's what it means, isn't it? It's learning, growing, and getting better and enjoying that process. And that's kind of what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I sometimes wonder about what if we had won an Olympic gold medal when I first got into the team, how that would have felt and what it would have meant back then to versus what it meant literally right at the end of my career. Because that striving for it was actually something that I can't even describe what it felt like. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just that striving for something. And to then, you know, to then achieve it, I know some of the, you know, other players in the team who are carrying on that period, who did carry on and are still playing that period afterwards, was quite challenging for them in a different way. So it's like, how do we go again?
Yeah, you guys got it good. You finished right on a high. See ya.
Thankfully. But lucky we did. we couldn't have planned it any better.
No. So, like I said, the journey that you all individually be on, so whether it was Kate talking about her journey to becoming captain, Alex, obviously the journey that she had, particularly after Rio, with banging her head, Danny in terms of the growth he had to go through after the way he wasn't entirely happy with himself, with the way he coached in 2008 through to you and the injuries. And going back, I still remember when London was announced as the host of 2012. Like, I remember exactly where I was. I was playing tennis at Queen's Club and I just heard this, way! For you and your teammates, that was crucial, wasn't it? Because hockey was in a bit of a dire state at that time. Funding had been slashed, and then because of that decision, you guys got a bit of money thrown back at you, which then fed into this, okay, let's talk about some of the intangibles, not just the tactics, not just the way we're going to play, but the stuff of the big picture stuff. So can you just talk about that, the beginning of that process?
Yeah, you know, I often say that the London Olympics saved hockey in this country, well, certainly international hockey in this country, because as you say, we'd failed to qualify for Athens, and then it was announced in 2005. And so if it hadn't been for then, I dread to think where hockey would be. And I think as a women's squad, we saw this quite rightly, I believe, as a once in a lifetime opportunity, home Olympic Games. We have to make the most of this. We have to give our all, we have to justify the funding that is now being put into our sport. And like you say, because we decided to train full time, that was a decision by Danny, which he put to us as a group, and thankfully there was a core of us who agreed. We knew we needed to change something, and so we set about deciding who we were about. And the first thing that we did in our full-time program was to decide on our vision. And the vision that we had for London was really different to the one that we had for Rio. Back then, we were ranked 9th in the world, I think, when we were deciding on our vision for London. We'd never really, in my career, in the first kind of 10 years, we'd never really competed for a medal, not truly. We hadn't made a proper semi-final other than the Europeans, of course, but on the world stage. And we set our vision as gold. And we had some very long and interesting discussions. And what I was most grateful for in those discussions was the honesty that people came up with. There was a real sense of fear of failure, fear of going for something and not reaching it. I remember this so vividly. There were some people who physically wouldn't say the word gold. They just wouldn't say it out loud, that we were that afraid of it. And so that vision that we came up with, you know, in hindsight and with the luxury of being able to now know what's happened in the future in terms of our vision for Rio, which was to be the difference, create history, inspire the future, really different vision. Much less about the kind of tangible outcome. Although the gold was not just about winning gold, it was about something greater, and it actually turned into something around kind of gold standards. But we had nobody in our squad at that time who had ever won a gold medal. We didn't know how to win a gold medal. And so we were guessing. And I felt it was actually really important at that stage that we could say the word gold and we could aim for it. And that really, I believe, set us on our path to the Rio gold. We didn't win gold in London, as I'm sure everyone knows, but we did get the bronze. Yeah. And I honestly don't believe that we would have got anywhere near if we hadn't kind of set our standards at that level. Because I think deep down inside of all of us, there's a sense of knowing, like, you know whether you've given your best. Like, if you're really honest with yourself.
Can't kid the person in the mirror, yeah.
Exactly. And I think up until 2010 was... So we set our vision right at the beginning of 2010, and then we played three tournaments that year. We played the Champions Trophy, which is a tournament for the top six, and we won the bronze medal. First medal at the Champions Trophy. We went to the World Cup, and we won a bronze medal. and we went to the Commonwealth Games and we won a bronze medal, which for the Commonwealth Games is actually a bit disappointing. But in the year that we had, that was fine. We won a bronze medal at the World Cup. And for the first time, I remember on the way home from the World Cup, Sally Munday, the chief executive at the time of England Hockey, was on our flight. And I can't even remember what question she asked me, probably about something like how are you feeling about this? And I just remember like thinking and feeling that there was just this level of satisfaction that I'd never had before. There was almost like a sense of knowing that I and we, the team and myself, had done and are doing everything that we possibly can. And that was rewarded with a bronze medal at a World Cup. It wasn't the gold, but even so, I knew we were on the right path at that moment. There was a, not satisfaction, it was more contentment. I was content because I was and am doing everything that I can. And I know that we all are doing that. And that was like a real moment for me because I'd never really experienced that before. It was either myself that, looking at myself, I didn't feel like I had been given it all or collectively as a team at some point, at, you know, every tournament that we went to. And don't get me wrong, you know, there was still that passion, there was still that drive, there was still that want to improve and get better. But we were now on the right path and I could see where it could go and that didn't exist before.
Mm. So that values and, you know, setting standards and connecting in terms of this big vision was obviously really integral in that. But it was interesting, I thought, what you said about, so you had the vision at 2012 was gold. And like you say, there's something static, if you like, about that to a degree. It's like a goal, isn't it? Whereas in 2016, you had this really beautiful thing, which was be the difference, create history, inspire the future. So the difference between the two is, as far as I can see. So the second one, so 2016, seems to be, it's really values orientated. It's like serving something bigger than yourselves, bigger than the outcome. And there's no doubt that you succeeded in, first of all, creating history. Second of all, inspiring the future. I mean, the number of people who took up hockey post 2016 was, I mean, it was staggering, wasn't it? It was tens of thousands. So why do you think there was that difference in terms of the visions piece, the values, the behaviors? What nudged it then from this gold and the goal-orientated part to it to this much bigger, you know, bigger than ourselves, values part that was the final piece of the jigsaw?
Yeah, I think there's probably a few things. I think one of the main things is that we were a different group of people, and there were some that were the same, but we were also different because of the experiences that we'd had in London, because of the experience that we'd had post London, with kind of the World Cup in particular in 2014. Oh, yeah. And all of that stuff. And also then what we became as a team, I think that was probably the biggest factor. You know, we went from being the most selfless team in London under that vision of gold to possibly being the most selfish team that I'd played in. It was not a nice place to be. I was experiencing my own personal challenges with my back injury at that time, and there was so much going on. There was a lot of us who were struggling personally, and there was just collectively we were also not in a great place, and there was a lot of us who were the same people from London to that point. And so kind of I think when we were then going through the process of deciding on our Rio vision, values and behaviors, it was coming from a really different place. We were wanting to find what our values were, actually.
So did you think you needed that dip? You know, actually you needed that period of selfishness to be able to establish, you know, that's really not how we want to be.
I think that probably influenced, yeah. I don't think we necessarily needed it. I don't think you do need that. But when we were then coming up with our vision, values and behaviours for a second time in the Rio cycle, because we'd done it before the World Cup with the coach that took over after London, and then Danny Kerry came back in as our coach in the lead up to Rio, and we went through that process again. And I think that what we had become as a team really did shape where we then took our vision and our values and our behaviours. And I think for the London cycle, we were much more experienced as a group of people, more mature, whereas for the Rio cycle, we lost a good number of players and people who would just had this, like, I don't know, it was like a maturity, like that ability to kind of, those people that really make teams tick. And we lost a lot of those people. Right. And so, you know, we were a different team. We were potentially asked different questions as well. You know, I do remember Danny asking that, you know, really pertinent question of how do you want to be remembered? And I think also one of the things that was, that potentially was, that troubled potentially myself and Kate and a few other of the senior players in the team was actually that after London, what we had created, what we felt like we had created was actually a little bit ignored. And so therefore, that's why when we then came up with our new vision, we wanted it to encompass what had gone before, not just us, but all the women and men who have built hockey in this country and made it what it is today. But we also then wanted it to be that future focus.
So that link to the past and the future.
Yeah, basically, also to sit in the here and now, which you know, to be the difference. And I got to be honest, like the vision, particularly that be the difference is something that still is a massive, it's probably more of a value of mine now. That's something that I live by.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Create history and inspire the future. It's quite obvious what that means. Whereas be the difference, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, what does that mean? So just going on what you said, is it that appreciating what's gone before, looking to inspire and pass the baton on to the future by performing in the here and now? Is that what it was? Or if not, correct me.
Be the difference was, well, I think this is the beauty of it as well, because we had so many discussions and these words were definitely had a kind of a meaning that everybody would have known what it was, but there also would have been different meanings that people would have taken for themselves, which is the beauty of that vision. So for example, like inspire the future has multiple kind of meanings. It could be inspire the next generation of hockey players, but it also inspire the future of ourselves, like tomorrow, potentially, do you know what I mean? And or inspire the future of next international hockey teams, like that kind of, there was lots of different, and also I think create history, there was the obvious one, which obviously did incorporate, which was to win the gold medal. But again, once you've won that gold medal, what is then next? And the next one is potentially to win another gold medal. That's still creating history. But be the difference, I think, was more, it actually came about by the, be the difference you wish to see in the world. Is that the quote? So to stand up for stuff, to rather than wait for somebody else to do it, you do it. Yeah, that kind of.
Oh, I see. So be that. Yes, of course. Be that the famous quote. Be the difference that you want to see in the world.
Yes.
Instead of pointing out and saying, "Oh, that annoys me," it's like, "Okay, no.
Yeah.
You be that thing that you want to see. So be what you.
Exactly. And if you see something that's not right, you be the difference. And that could be, you know, that had connotations for outside of our team. And particularly, I mean, you know, where the kind of world that we live in right now, that goes to so many different places.
Yeah, totally.
But for us as a team in the here and now, that was also every single day, be the difference by making sure that you bring your protein shake to the gym, making sure you do your activation properly, your rehab, your prehab, that all those little behaviors that are the difference. If you see somebody not doing living by our vision, values and behaviors, be the difference and go and have that conversation. It's about being the difference to do the hard stuff, about the discipline. All of that stuff.
That's great. No, I really like that, because I wasn't sure, but actually that makes total sense to me. You know, whether it be, we hear a lot about kindness, don't we now? I'll be kind. And then often people who pipe that up aren't necessarily always that kind. But it's instead of saying, I want to speed the world to be kinder, forget the world. You be as kind as you can be.
Exactly.
And this is
what start with yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Start with yourself, right? And that, to me, the difference then between 2012 and 2016 is it felt a bit static in 2012 to a degree, whereas in 2016 that it could be interpreted in so many ways. It was living, it was breathing, it was like a dynamic, flowing organism of its own kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the vision certainly did. For me personally, I think the difference between London and, so for me, when I think about the London team, actually the squad in and around the actual games time wasn't hugely different. How I felt, the contentment, the pride, all of the sense of belonging was really, really similar. I believe that the difference between why we won gold at one and bronze at the other was potentially one of our values that we had for the Rio cycle, mm-hmm. which was we are winners.
Right.
And I think when we were going through the process, again, of deciding on our vision, values and behaviours, we were really honest with ourselves. And one of those conversations that we had was actually, we potentially don't know how to win, or we don't believe, is there a belief issue? We don't talk about winning enough. We don't celebrate winning enough. It's not necessarily in our kind of DNA, mm-hmm. perhaps as a team right now. And so we need to make that happen, because otherwise we won't win. Mm. And so that's about the being able to, I often think about the game, when you think about sporting finals in particular, semi-finals, that kind of stuff, very rarely will you see a game won by more than one or two goals. Like, those games are hard.
Mm.
They are tough from start to finish. And it's about enjoying being in that kind of moment, in learning how to deal with the pressure of that moment, understanding your emotions and all of that stuff. And then like the critical moments in games, like the first 5 minutes, the last 5 minutes, when you go a goal up, when you go a goal down, when you have a player sent off, like all of those different things. And that's why I think the combination of what we had as a squad with the coaching staff, and it was almost like one of those, just those moments where everything came together.
Mm.
And we learned, we honestly learned how to win. One of our kind of phrases or mantras at the Olympic Games was, and beforehand, was find a way to win. And we believed that we could find a way to win from any position. And that doesn't just happen. That comes through training, and that comes through time, and it comes through it happening. And so, you know, little moments that contributed to that, and obviously a big moment that contributed to allowing us to beat the Dutch in the Olympic final was beating the Dutch in the European final as England a year prior, when we were 2-0 down with 8 minutes to go, and we got it back to penalties. We got the goals back, we got it back to penalties, and we won on penalties. And so just the kind of synergy between that and then the Rio final, we believed we could win because we had taught ourselves how to do it.
That's nice because you hear that people say, you know, winners are born, not made, but actually it's a load of gubbins, isn't it? It's a skill you can learn.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like the kind of I always think about the Fergie time that people often got annoyed with, because they would score with 90 plus 3 on the clock, and it's like that doesn't happen by accident. They believe they will get a chance, and they believe they will put it in. And it's about a mindset. And some people that comes a lot easier.
Yeah.
Obviously, of course. But those things can be learned.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember a coach of mine, a club coach that I had, who made that point really clearly before a big league game that we had, like at half time. He was, I think it was maybe level. I think we were level at half time, and you know, whatever happens in the, on the seven, you know, even if there's 69 minutes on the clock, we will get another chance and we will score it. And it's just having that belief,
yeah, yeah.
That over the whole the course of the whole game,
yeah,
we
yeah.
will win.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You mentioned earlier about knowing yourself, which will lead us into Thinking Thursday in a sec. So I want to just, because Kate told me how for her it was anger management each week, and I'm interested on your reaction. But before we get onto that, and again, I'm sort of dotting around in time because we will go back to 2014 in a sec. But so once the World Cup had been a bit of a disaster, and like you say, there was this mood of a bit more selfishness than had been the case. And then there's the famous meeting that you had, and Danny spoke about this and Kate spoke about this in terms of sort of radical candor, blood on the wall, as it were, get in there and like, you're not coming out till it's all been said. What are your recollections of going in there, and how tough was that?
Yeah, that was really, really, really tough. So we did have a psychologist, but he actually left within this period, and we got a kind of an interim psychologist who was one of the, I think, the best psychologists in the EIS. And she was tasked with coming together for this meeting. And she it was the first time she'd met us all and the last time. And I think she must have walked out that room thinking, oh, my gosh, because honestly,
wow.
I mean, she was amazing. And what she created was a space. A very safe space for us to voice what was going on deep down in all of us. And I remember being very fearful going into that meeting, because mainly because of my own insecurities and my own vulnerabilities that I knew I needed to voice. I knew that I needed to apologize for my part in what we had become. And I was incredibly grateful that a lot of us did that. It was. I mean, at the time, it was hideous.
Of course.
So hideous. You know, there was a lot of tears. There was actually something which there was shouting and a lot of anger, which is really unusual. You know, it doesn't often get to that place, but it was so, so necessary. And I'm honestly so proud of all of the team in that room to really say what they were feeling, how others had made them feel and stuff like that, which is so hard.
Which is
so hard to do, to be really honest. But people, I think ultimately, none of us liked where we were at that point. That was probably what, you know, the connection that we had was that we wanted to make this better somehow.
Yeah.
We didn't know how. But yeah, we needed to start here.
Yeah. And Kate said a similar thing. Actually said, you know, since retiring and going into businesses, for example, so many of the problems stem from things left unsaid. And I know in my own family, you know, and I'm sure a lot of British families are like this, where it's like, you know, don't make a scene, just sweep it under the carpet. And so you can be at like a big family, can't you? And you can sense this sort of anger bubbling under the surface. But so actually, and like you say, it can be, it's tough, like having tough conversations, and your mind is like, please don't go there. Like you don't, like you said, you were feeling fearful. You didn't want to go and do that, but they are so important. And I don't think I've ever, particularly if you can go in and go, look, I feel like this, and don't necessarily just pin the blame on the other person and say, like, I feel like this when you do this, but it's not like you make me feel like this. So our little girl will say to me at the moment, she's like, you're making me so mad. I'm like, I'm really not. Like you are mad and I happen to be here, but the two are not as intimately connected as you believe. But I'm interested. So when you sort of came out of it then, can you quantify how cathartic it was? And did you have that sense of like a huge weight off your shoulders individually and collectively? Or did that take time? Were you a bit raw for a while?
I think there was a rawness to it. I remember we did it in December, so it was before Christmas, so before a kind of natural break that we had in our program. And then we came back in January with a brand new psychologist, which was probably for the best because, yeah, we needed that freshness. I think over that Christmas period, it probably took a bit of time for us all to just individually figure it out. But I do think there was a a sense of, in fact, actually, and this is what we really tried to do within our squad on from that point was, you know, once you've had a chance to have your say and you leave a meeting, then that's it.
Mm-hmm. Forever hold your peace.
Exactly. So I think that's, and that definitely would have come up in that meeting. So I think that's why everything came out. Yeah, I do think it was a moment, actually.
Yeah.
Put a full stop on it and move forward.
Yeah, like I said, I've tried to embrace difficult conversations increasingly, and they're hard. And then I look back, it's like, oh, well, there's this quantum leap forward, actually, in the quality of your relationship by doing that. It's like airing the cupboards out, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not fun at the time, but it's like a massive spring clean. But
you're right.
And then I do want to ask about that self-awareness piece, which will lead us on to various other trajectories. But with the Thinking Thursday, which I've spoken about a lot with Kate, with Danny, and you'd get this email and split into teams and the rules had changed, the captains had changed, you know, there'd be unfairness and all this stuff, but you were still trying to win within that. So it's this training yourself to be able to thrive in really challenging situations, which inevitably the end of an Olympics semi-final, final, they're going to be like that. But I remember Kate saying that she would get angry. What would be your go-to? So, because, and Danny as well. So Danny said, as I'm sure you know, like when Danny's under pressure, he goes inwards and can see Mardy, right? Oh, that's the impression I've got.
Yeah.
Right. So where did you go?
That's because Kate was on the orange team more often than not, which was labelled anger management. I was also a really emotional player, and actually realised that it was a massive strength of mine. And so I needed to harness that emotion rather than, because I did at one point, I tried to not have the emotion because sometimes it was detrimental, you know, as we know it can be. But I just felt numb when I didn't have that. And so I had to really learn to harness it. I think there was a little bit of anger was definitely an emotion that was quite up there, if I'm honest. Mm-hmm. But I learned to really use it to drive me. I potentially would get, angry, or not angry, I guess, frustrated with I could get frustrated with other players if I didn't feel like they were doing stuff. And that was me. That wasn't them. That was on me. And potentially in the past, I wouldn't have communicated with those people in a way that was going to help them. And again, you know, the work that we did as a collective on all of this stuff, most of it was about how can we get the best out of each other, because we're playing as a team here. And if I'm going to shout at someone and that doesn't help them, then why would I do that? And so we had some really great, honest conversations around our strengths and what we need to get the best out of ourselves, and what we're like on a good day and what we're like on a bad day and what happens to us and all of those types of things. And one of the things that I learned, and massive, massive takeaway for me, was about how my impact is on people around me, not just on the pitch, but also off it. But yeah, on the pitch, it was learning what other people needed from me when the pressure was on. I knew my strengths, and so therefore I needed to also deliver on those. And a lot of that was to do with communication. A lot of that was to do with the intensity of standard. That was one of my strengths that I brought to the team. But yeah, when I was angry and frustrated at people, I needed to communicate that in the best way. And that's why Thinking Thursday was just so great. From the moment you got the email, you know, the fact that we got sent an email the night before actually kind of played into it as well. You know, we'd finished our club training session and we'd go over to our phones and like, oh, we've got an email. Like, you just want the night off.
You just want
to go home and have a shower and get into bed and not think about it. But you're having to think about the next day and prepare. And sometimes the teams would get start a WhatsApp group. Okay, these are the points. What do you think for tomorrow? And then actually over time, we learned that we couldn't always do that. And that possibly wasn't always the best. And actually, can we meet in the morning and come up with some stuff quite quickly? it challenged our togetherness, it challenged the way we work together, but it also challenged the, you know, the ultimate thing of working out how to best play in this game. We weren't being told by the coaches, we were doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Full ownership. Yeah. No, yeah. It's so powerful thinking Thursday, and it's been, like, I've loved chatting about it. And which leads me then really into the self-awareness piece. So you talk about Brené Brown, right? So her famous TED talk about authenticity, right? And Kate quoted her verbatim very impressively during our chat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The thing that came from it for me was that good things come from being yourself. And I think it's something I learned over time, was as someone who perhaps was looking for a long time for ways to fix things I didn't like about myself. Actually, no, the truth of the matter is it's about being more you.
Yeah, it was, I think for me personally, like, as I said before, when I first listened to that TED talk,
because you were in a dark time. This was, just to recap. So this was, you'd had your back surgeries, been told, oh, you might not make it back to the top level, 2014, and you went into a bit of a dark place. So it came along at a right time for you.
Yeah, and it's called The Power of Vulnerability for those people who haven't seen it. And she made me realize that what I was experiencing was normal. And this goes on at kind of micro and macro levels in everybody's life all the time. And I think when I am not at my best, I start to compare myself with others. I think lots of us do that. And we can't be anybody else. No. We can only be the best of ourselves. And I think, again, that is a huge learning of mine. And I still creep back into it. I still, you know, you see people being praised for doing X, Y, and Z. You get an attention for doing, you know, this or that. And you think, oh, yeah, I need to do that. I need to be this. And actually, no, just you need to be yourself and own yourself. And yeah, another Brené Brown thing, you know, she says about owning your story, owning who you are, because that's all we have, actually. For me, like you said, it's not about fixing you. It's actually really
accepting, I always say.
Yeah, accepting. It's acknowledging the different bits of you as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there are, you know, we have different roles that we play, you know, as a partner, as a daughter, as a mother, as a teammate, as a whatever. And so there's not just one aspect of you. Like, there's so many different things, and it's they're the roles that we play, and we're probably slightly different people within those things. And getting to grips with, that's okay. And it's not, to be authentic, you have to be this same thing all the time. It's not about that. It's recognizing all those different parts of you. And some of them you'll like, and some of them you won't like as much. That's also important to recognize. And it's not, like you say, it's not about fixing it. It's about accepting that this is me. Yes, some of those things, if there are things that you don't like about yourself, and actually some of those things, then they might be things that you maybe need to work on, because if they're having a detrimental effect in a workplace or with your family, then it can't just be a case of, well, this is me, and you know, like it or lump it type thing. You do need to recognize those things and work on them. But yeah, I think when I'm at my best, it's when I really understand myself. I am true to who I am. I'm not trying to be anything other than me. And I'm still grappling with that.
But I think it's such a fascinating topic, and I really like the fact that you use the word roles, because, like you say, we've all got these roles that we play that we have to step into, right? But I think it can be easy, and I'm interested to know what you think of this, to overly identify with our role. So for example, you know, as athletes, oftentimes you hear that, you know, they retire and then they've lost that identity. And I know actually you spoke about this in 2014. This was something you grappled with, the identity of, oh, hang on, I was this sports person, now I'm not, whether that be through injury or retirement. But actually, I think the more you can see these things, and whatever they are, as roles rather than who you are, you can handle them with a light touch. Like, for example, with you, I know you were really, really confident as a hockey player. And then post 2014, suddenly you weren't.
It's more like saying, so I would always say, I'm a hockey player. But that's then, I'm then attaching hockey to me, yeah, rather than I'm Helen and I play hockey.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Just that little bit of difference on what you attach your identity to. And yeah, like hockey was hugely my identity. And, you know, that whole thing of introducing yourself. I'm Helen and I'm a hockey player. And that was literally who I was and what I was about. And it's important to have those different things that you kind of really value and you have in your life.
It's a deep question, isn't it?
Really, yeah.
It's a big question because, I mean, identity is such a big thing. But like I said, I think for me, it's like, okay, understanding their roles. And then you can value more values, for example. It's like, how do you want to be? Rather than what I am. So it comes back, it's almost like what you said about the difference between 2012 and 16, right? It's like, okay, we want to have, this is just speaking in a simplistic way, have gold v these kind of much broader, you know, we want to inspire, we want to be, we want to blah, 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 blah. Mm. So which is, it's just a, like I said, sort of more, yeah, more flowing or an organic. That resonates with me when it comes to this, the biggest of questions.
No, that's really true, actually. And yeah, like you say, the words that we used for the Rio visions and values, because our values were to we are one team, we are winners, and be alive. And they're all, yeah, like you say, they're all being things. They're all about, yeah, what you're about, as opposed to who you are. And yeah, that's really true. I'm not sure I've thought about it in that way.
There we go. It's a really interesting one, I think.
Yeah.
Because when we, like, so for me, the people I really admire, the people who, and I've got to be honest, without being too generalizing, I notice it more with some ex-pro men than women. They can often cling to that, I was this player, I won this thing. And I'd see them in media centers and they still have that kind of swagger. And actually, it's a bit like, yeah, that was then. You're not that anymore. And it's almost a bit tragic. Whereas, you know, we're always changing and evolving and there is nothing static. And I think that's why I really admire, like I say, people who recognize that, even perhaps in the midst of their careers.
Certainly for me, finishing hockey and having to find a new path. And I started working with Spurs women as a performance psychologist. And there was definitely a part of me, and I don't mind admitting it, because I think it's possibly within all of us. Like we all have our ego, and there was definitely a part of me when I remember kind of being out on the pitch with them, and they were doing their training, and then I was helping collect the balls in afterwards, and they pick up the cones and stuff like that. And I was like, there was definitely a part of me thinking, oh, I'm an Olympic gold medalist, and I'm doing this, and I'm at the bottom. I feel like I'm at the bottom of the rung again.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what I could have done is be, I don't want to do that. I'm above that. That's not my values.
No.
But it went through my mind and I reflected on it and I questioned it. And I thought, no, actually, because I want to, what I've been about throughout the whole of my career is learning and growing and trying to get better to be the best. I wanted to win. I felt like I was a winner in that respect. But now I'm starting again, and my ego is being tested at times, I'm honest. And I'm in places and I'm thinking, also the other way, in terms of, God, I don't feel like I'm good enough to be here. But I have to question that as well. Like, no, you do know, you've got, yes, you might not have the experience in this actual kind of working life, but the experience you have within teams and what you've done and felt and thought and kind of been exposed to and inputted into, is massive. So it goes both ways. Like my ego, you know, one day could be like, why am I doing
this? Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and then the other way is like, oh, I can't, you know, I can't do this. And
it's two sides of the same coin, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's been, and that, but that's why coming back to authenticity and being true to who you are, that's why it's so important in those moments to know who you are. What am I about? And actually I'm kind of exploring that at the moment. Like I had this part of my life and I'm now moving in a new exciting direction. What do I want to be about? And I've started to actually write some of this stuff down. It's always going on in my head, but I actually want to start writing some of this down and really, really truly understand what I want to be about, so that when I am challenged, because I will be, it could be tomorrow, it could be in, you know, 3 months time, when I am challenged, I really truly understand me and what I stand for.
Yeah, that's your, so that's the values bit, isn't it? Yeah, that's why I think it's bit. You know, it's so important, like you say, it can be, it's like an anchor or a compass, you know, like to drive. Right, last few things. You've been very generous with your time, but I'll tell you one thing in terms of vulnerability and authenticity, something I've heard you talk about which I think is really interesting. So when we think of being vulnerable, oftentimes people think it's like sharing, oh, I'm scared about this, I feel bad about that, blah, blah, blah. But actually, for us Brits in particular, oftentimes the harder thing is being vulnerable about what we think we're good at. Like the amount of people who are rubbish at taking compliments, you know, you're, you know, like, and so, yeah, can you just talk to me about the vulnerability of owning your strength?
Exactly. Like we did work on our strengths and our super strengths. And it was really apparent to me that I knew there were people in that room when we were doing it in our team that, and I was probably one of them, to be fair, that knew their strengths. But to actually stand up and say out loud to everybody, this is what I am amazing at, was really hard. Because I do think it is a little bit of a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. Because in this, well, certainly from my experience in this country, if you say what you're good at, you're deemed to be arrogant.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to be arrogant. No. It's seen as a negative thing. And so, but I potentially, having spoken to, you know, a few people from America, I think they are much more comfortable
at being positive
and saying what they're good at. And actually that's a little bit more normal for them. And so I think, and also, you know, knowing your strengths and owning them is such a powerful thing. And being able to stand up and say what you're good, because potentially there is that fear though, that people won't agree. I think that probably is the biggest fear. The thing of being seen as arrogant, but then there's also the thing of, are you sure?
That's
what you think you're good at? And then you're like, oh,
yeah, yeah. Uh-oh. Yeah, you know, yeah, maybe
so,
you're right.
So there's that aspect as well.
Yeah. But it's surprising vulnerability part, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, because you would, it's somewhat counterintuitive. Right. So you've shared a lot of, like you say, you're a big thinker, right? So it's no huge surprise that you've gone into psychology, bagged this top job with Spurs. So, and I'm, you know, I know when you have done your course and your master's and whatever else, there's lots of theories and textbooks and all these things that you could draw on. So two parts to this question. First of all, do you draw more on what you've learned or your experience? And what are the key things, if you had to summarize the key things that you try and take into to help the team and the squad and the support stuff and everything like that?
I think I draw probably mainly on my experience as a hockey player and what I experienced within our team over the 18-year career that I had. You know, there was the good, the bad and the ugly of what it is to be in a team. And then, do you know what? I think that the biggest thing that I feel like is useful for everybody is around the self-awareness first. And again, it's probably self-awareness, but it's bigger than that. It's knowing yourself and who you are, that, like, basically the kind of this conversation that we've just had. But then also the self-awareness of how you're impacting people around you.
Yeah.
And really understanding understanding yourself. Yeah, like what drives you, what motivates you, what annoys you, what, and how can you then influence the people around you as well in a positive way?
Totally agree with you. Okay, I'm going to come back to our original question then. So now, so you've done, so, yeah. You've had over an hour to percolate on this, Helen. So no more excuses. What is the thread that links all your stuff, do you think?
I'm thinking, I haven't got a great answer to this.
You don't need a great one.
Something along the lines of.
Here we go. Drum roll.
I think there's something along the lines of being open to grow, to new things, to challenge.
So it's an exploration thing. It comes back to that kind of explore. Yeah. It's like being open. And so it's putting yourself in the arena.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Guys, the Brené Brown thing again. What a surprise. That openness.
Curiosity. Being curious and having that courage to do it, and regardless of the outcome.
We got there. Anyway, listen, Helen, I just want to say a big thank you. Spurs are lucky to have you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. So I just want to say a huge thank you. Please say hello to Kate for me. Like I said, I love the story of you and your teammates and everything that you've all been through individually, collectively. It's a privilege. So just thank you.
No, you're very welcome, Simon. It's been for myself as well. It's really lovely to be able to reflect on the not so good stuff, but also the amazing stuff that we did as a team. And who knows where it will end up going in the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Helen Richardson Walsh. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting to her. I'd love to hear what you think. Message me at Simon Mundy. If you could as well give Don't Tell Me The Score a rating, hopefully 5 stars, and a kind review, I would be very grateful, and I will pay it forward. Also out today is part 2 of my chat with Rupert Spira about a philosophy of sport, or really the nature of reality. And I would suggest that is one to listen to while you are not doing anything else, as we do go pretty deep. Anyway, that's it for now. Thank you again for listening. I really do appreciate it. I'll be back next Monday for another episode of Don't Tell Me The Score, and I hope you'll join me then.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.